Well, senescent cells were first reported by Len Hayflick and Moorhead back in 1961. Moorhead discovered that cells from humans or other animals with a backbone have a limited number of times they can divide before they stop dividing or until they die. And they found that some cells could undergo a limited number of replications, and then their dividing time slowed down. They entered a state of what we call presenescence, when they only had a few divisions left to them. And then they entered a phase of senescence where they just stopped dividing. And if they hadn't died, they would persist. In fact, they're resistant to dying.
Welcome to Longevity by Design, a podcast designed to give individuals access to the leading scientific information in the field of longevity. The ability to add years to your life and life to your years needs no opinion. Join us as we ask science to take the wheel. In each episode, Dr. Gil Blander joins a co-host and an industry expert in the field of longevity, shining a light and getting the answers to the key question: how can we live a longer, healthier life?
Hello, I'm Ashley Reaver, and I'm joined by Dr. Gil Blander. Welcome to Longevity by Design, How to Live a Longer, Healthier Life. We're produced by Insight Tracker, your science-based guide to optimizing your body from the inside out. Our guest today is Dr. James Kirkland, who will discuss aging research and the impact of cellular senescence and senolytic therapies on age-related chronic diseases and health span. Dr. Kirkland is the Nobar Foundation Professor of Aging Research at Mayo Clinic. Dr. Kirkland's research is on the contribution of fundamental aging processes, particularly cellular senescence, to age-related and chronic diseases, and the development of gerotherapeutics, which are agents and strategies for targeting fundamental aging mechanisms to treat age and chronic disease-related conditions. Dr. Kirkland's laboratory published the first article about agents that selectively eliminate senescent cells or senolytic drugs. Dr. Kirkland demonstrated that senolytic agents enhance health span and delay, prevent, or alleviate multiple age-related disorders and diseases in mouse models. He published the first composite biomarker geriodiagnostic score of senescent cell burden that is sensitive to drug interventions in humans and the first clinical trials of senolytic drugs. He's preparing or conducting clinical studies on senolytics, including for COVID-19, frailty in elderly women, Alzheimer's disease, diabetes and obesity, osteoporosis, childhood cancer survivors, restoring functions of organs from old donors to enable transplantation, idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, preeclampsia, glioblastoma, and others. He has more than 295 publications and holds over 40 patents. Dr. Kirkland is the principal investigator of the Translational Geroscience Network, which brings together multiple academic institutions to translate health span interventions, including senolytic and other drugs that target fundamental aging processes. He is the president of the American Federation for Aging Research, a past member of the National Advisory Council on Aging of the NIH, past chair of the Biological Sciences Section of the Gerontological Society of America, and past member of the Clinical Trials Advisory Panel of the National Institutes of Aging. He is a board-certified specialist in internal medicine, geriatrics, and endocrinology and metabolism. He was the 2020 recipient of the Irving S. Wright Award of Distinction from the American Federation for Aging Research. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks.
So it's a great pleasure having you, Dr. Kirkland. And we always like to start with a question that asks, what led you to become a scientist?
Well, I first became a clinical geriatrician and then became a scientist from there. And the reason I became a geriatrician is that my first memory at 18 months of age was my grandfather looking down at me. And so I was always interested in clinical and research aspects of aging. I started working as a geriatrician, and I got a little frustrated by, you know, constantly trying to find better wheelchairs, walkers, and incontinence devices, and wanted to do something more fundamental. So I went back and did a PhD in biology of aging, and have tried to marry those two things together now. You know, what can we do? What can we understand about fundamental aging processes? And how can that inform clinical decision making and ultimately maybe one day devise interventions so that we can delay, prevent, alleviate, or treat multiple conditions across the lifespan that are related to aging processes?
And did you always know before that that you wanted to be a physician, or was it specifically just working with geriatric population that really drove you to that career path?
Well, I like both. I am particularly interested in the elderly and their issues, you know, because of, as I mentioned, family connections. And I've always been interested in science and medicine.
Interesting. So we would like to deep dive a bit into aging. And maybe we'll start with the basic. And can you explain to our audience what is geroscience? And what are the fundamental aging mechanisms that are happening in our body?
Well, there are aging processes, what we call fundamental aging mechanisms or pillars of aging or various names, that are roughly similar across all the animals with backbones, from fish up, and even some invertebrates. So we begin aging at or before conception. Down syndrome, for example, is a disorder related to cellular senescence, and that begins with aging of the egg cell in the mother before it's even fertilized. We're always aging. And the geroscience hypothesis holds, though, that if there's acceleration of these fundamental aging processes, that can drive a lot of conditions downstream. So people divide up the pillars or hallmarks of aging into anywhere from 4 to 15 categories, but they're all highly interlinked. If you target one, you tend to affect all the rest. There are things upstream of these fundamental aging mechanisms that can accelerate them. We know that particular family histories can do it. Things like radiation exposure, certain drugs, certain disorders like obesity and diabetes, stress and all kinds of other things can drive some of these processes. Then they get channeled, these things that can accelerate fundamental aging processes get channeled through these pillars or fundamental aging mechanisms, and they can result in multiple downstream consequences. A range of disorders and diseases across the lifespan, as I mentioned, they can be acute, they can be chronic. Another thing that they tend to drive is what we call loss of resilience. That is decreased ability to, say, recover quickly after surgery or after a wound, or to have a proper response to a vaccine. They can affect what we call the geriatric syndrome. So that's things like onset and when it occurs during life, of things like frailty or muscle weakness or cognitive impairment, over and above what happens with things like Alzheimer's disease, or trouble making it to the bathroom, and all these other geriatric syndromes. So there are a whole range of things, even acute diseases, that, and even in children, that these fundamental aging processes, if they're operating quickly, they tend to operate in tandem, and they can result in multiple disorders. And that's quite evident, because when we see that these processes are operating, we tend not to see just one disorder or disease in a person. We see something called multimorbidity. So if someone gets one age-related condition, the time is pretty short before they get to the next. And they tend to occur sequentially. They occur faster and faster. And as a geriatrician, what I'm constantly dealing with is people with what we call multimorbidity, that is multiple diseases and conditions at the same time, for which they may be on 5, 10, or 20 drugs, polypharmacy. And we want to reduce that. So if we could target these fundamental aging processes, arguably, but it's looking like in experimental animals, we can target multiple conditions at the same time. And hopefully one day, if people are on 10 drugs, get them down to 5 or 4 or 2.
Makes sense. And that's exciting.
And it sounds, versus targeting aging versus the traditional medical system, the big difference is, one, we kind of wait to develop and then we treat all of them. Can you kind of weigh the differences in targeting aging leading to all of these versus how we treat older individuals now?
Well, most of medicine is focused on treating people who are already sick. And indeed, when it comes to regulatory authorities, that's how we have to approach this because, as a physician, the main thing we're taught is the Hippocratic Oath. And what it says in it is first, do no harm. And so with new interventions that are completely new, that aren't sort of simple things like lifestyle interventions like exercise, but if it's a drug, we really have to start with people with established diseases with those agents to look for safety and tolerability, see if we're actually targeting the fundamental aging process and seeing if at least we can slow down progression of a disease or maybe even slightly reverse it. And we call that, looking at risk benefit ratios. So if something's been around for a long time, we know it's relatively safe, like certain kinds of diets or sleep wake rhythms or certain kinds of exercise. We can use those in a preventive manner at this point. But when it comes to new interventions, we have to ethically really start with people who have disorders, especially if it's a potentially dangerous drug that we're using and it may have side effects, where there is no good treatment for it and the patients and their families have no other option. So there's a whole range of things that we have to look at, right from treatment to what we call secondary prevention. And secondary prevention is if there's one age-related disease already, can we reduce the time before the person gets the next age-related disease? And then if things are really safe, we can do primary prevention in people in their 30s, 40s, and 50s who don't have symptoms yet. But it would be horrible to make a mistake in that population and to introduce an agent that causes problems. And also, it's very difficult to do studies of primary prevention unless we have good markers of what we're trying to treat, you know, that we can measure in blood or urine or in physical function or by imaging, because we can't do trials that take 60 years to complete. You know, we can't start an intervention in people in their 30s and see if they live to be 100.
Sure.
Yeah, makes sense. And we interviewed a couple of weeks ago, Jamie from the XPRIZE, and we discussed the XPRIZE. I'm sure that you are involved in one way or each other, the $101 million prize for basically extending the lifespan, not the lifespan, extending the lifespan of two or three organs by 10 to 20 years. And we also interviewed Nir Barzilai actually a week ago or a bit more about what he's doing with metformin. That's actually the first, as much as I know, the first clinical trial with aging-related diseases in human, which is very exciting with this metformin target. So it is exciting. But maybe before that, I still want to stay in the 30,000 foot view. Can you define gerotherapeutics? And what is the relevant for health span and lifespan?
Well, gerotherapeutics is a broad term. It's sort of equivalent to the term geroscience. And that asks, gerotherapeutics are interventions. And again, they could be lifestyle. They could be natural products. They could be repurposed drugs. They could be new chemical entities that target one or more fundamental aging processes. Generally, they target several of them. To see if we can delay, prevent, or alleviate or treat conditions that are associated with these fundamental aging processes. So there are many of them at the moment, well over 30. Many of them are at or in clinical trials at the moment. It's going to be important to compare them. It's going to be important to determine who should get which intervention when, because for example, with senolytics, the drugs that we developed, if you don't have senescent cells, why would you give senolytics? You just cause side effects. So the timing, we've got to have biomarkers that we can measure in what we call liquid biopsies from blood or urine or by imaging or something like that to know which intervention to give when and in whom. It has to be personalized. And what combinations of interventions to use. And so some of these interventions are things like certain forms of exercise. But even exercise follows what we call an inverted U-shaped curve. There's the right amount of exercise for someone, and there's too little, and there's too much. Yeah. So, for example, in the military, they're concerned about too much exercise causing knee arthritis and fractures around the knee joint, what we call microfractures. Yeah. And that's one of the main reasons military units can't be put into action, even more than bullet wounds. It's this kind of thing. So there can be too much exercise of the wrong type. So everything needs to be studied carefully. Too much caloric restriction obviously wouldn't be very good. But the right amount is. And so lifestyle interventions and everything, we've got to have the right biomarkers, select the right individuals for those interventions at the right point, sequence them, and then when they're disease states, combine the right gerotherapeutic interventions with the right specific disease-related treatments. So there'll be interactions between them. And it's being found now that for certain disease states, there may be a drug that works a little bit. But if we add a drug or an intervention that targets fundamental aging processes, we can greatly amplify the benefits of those drugs that are disease specific if we do it at the right time and the right patient and the right way.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. And again, when we discussed it with Neil a few weeks ago, he provided the example of metformin that he is not recommending someone below the age of 50 to take it, but someone above the age of 50, if you have a specific condition, then take it. So it's the same way. I think even in cancer today, when someone diagnosed with cancer, they are doing a genetic testing, and then based on that, they decide what drug to provide. So I see it's very similar for the gerotherapeutics. Let's find what, as you said, if you don't have senescent cells, why to use senolytics? And speaking about senescent cells, so for our listeners that never heard about senescence, can you explain what are senescent cells?
Well, senescent cells were first reported by Len Hayflick and Moorhead back in 1961. In fact, Leonard Hayflick is still alive. He's in his late 90s. So he and Moorhead discovered that cells from humans or other animals with a backbone, but they studied human cells to begin with, have a limited number of times that they can divide before they stop dividing or until they die or whatever. And they found that some cells, after repeatedly dividing them in cell culture, that's how they originally did the experiments. They were taking human lung cells and putting them in culture. They found they could undergo a limited number of replications, and then their dividing time slowed down and down and down. They entered a state of what we call presenescence, when they only had a few divisions left to them. And then they entered a phase of senescence, where they just stopped dividing. And if they hadn't died, they would persist. In fact, they're resistant to dying. So senescent cells generally are larger than normal cells. They have essentially irreversible loss of ability to divide. It was many years before people realized that this isn't just a culture phenomenon, that these cells are actually appearing in people. And so it turns out that senescent cells have important functions. Having a limited number of times that a cell can divide puts a brake on cancer development, because cancers have, they can divide over and over and over again, and that's the problem with them. Cancer cells divide very quickly. Senescent cells, it turns out, many of them, well, virtually all of them have something that we call a senescence-associated secretory phenotype, a long term, I'll just call it SASP, S-A-S-P. And this means that they produce certain factors that can modify cells nearby and at a great distance. The nature of the things that senescent cells produce depends very much on the kind of cell that became senescent, how long it's been senescent, how the senescence was induced. Like, was it reduced by repeated division? Was it induced by mechanical stress? Was it induced because it's on the verge of becoming cancerous? Was it induced because there are high blood sugar levels or high insulin levels or an infection? That affects the nature of the things that senescent cells produce. But every senescent cell has a SASP, but the nature is very different. And you can find over 1,000-fold differences in the things that they produce. But in other words, senescent cells have even though they're quite rare, even in people who've got, who are very elderly or who've been exposed to radiation or had chemotherapy that can induce senescence, they're quite rare, but they produce factors. And they're not just proteins and peptides. They produce all kinds of bioactive molecules. They produce things related to RNA and DNA that they release. They can have an impact body-wide. And indeed, you can have senescent cells in one part of the body. They will affect all of the rest of the body if there are enough of them.
So it's like an hormone. The SAS are in a way an hormone in the way that they behave because they can influence different organs from so far away.
Yes. So they have what we call paracrine or local effects, and they have endocrine effects. And indeed, they can spread senescence. And senescent cells are normally only removed by the immune system. They're very, very resistant to dying. So there are certain cells in the immune system that, whose job it is to clear them. But if they accumulate because they can spread beyond a certain threshold, they begin to, their rate of spread can exceed the ability of the immune system to clear them. And then indeed they can start poisoning the immune system and then they can take off. But in people who have a good immune system, senescent cells have to form or you would get cancer. If you stop senescent cells from forming, you get cancer.
Yeah.
So, but what happens is these cancer harboring senescent cells get cleared by the immune system. So this is a defense against cancer. And then other situations where they're necessary, during embryonic development. So there's something called a mesonephros. That's sort of a weird version of a kidney that embryos have. They don't have a proper kidney. That has to, once the kidneys develop in the developing baby, the mesonephros has to be removed, and that's done through senescence. The placenta contains a lot of senescent cells, and in the last 5 days of pregnancy, they produce the factors that drive the baby through the birth canal. And if there's a problem with the membrane between the placenta, which is on the fetal side, and the mother, senescent cells can spread to the mother, and this condition called preeclampsia can occur, where the mother gets high blood pressure and has problems with subsequent pregnancies and can get acceleration of age-related processes. So there are many, many situations where senescent cells are necessary, but if they persist, or if there are too many of them, they will cause tremendous problems. We'll take an example of the elephant, for example. The elephant is a huge animal. They develop from one sperm and one egg. They have repeated cell divisions. They almost never die of cancer. Only around 2% of elephants die from cancer. And that's partly because they have accelerated formation of senescent cells. They form very quickly in response to any kind of cancerous damage. But their immune system is designed so they clear those senescent cells immediately. So they can live a very long time. The same with some whale species. They can live a very long time, and they tend not to ever develop cancer. So senescent cells can be beneficial. But when they run away and you can't clear them, and their formation rate exceeds the ability of the immune system to clear them, and they start poisoning the immune system, then they can spread everywhere. And this may be one of the reasons you see multimorbidity, for example.
Yeah, I was going to ask that question before. You said you can give treatment for primary prevention. Hopefully someday maybe giving treatment for secondary prevention. Is this specifically what secondary prevention being conditions that would be caused by those senolytic cells spreading?
Well, the first trials are actually in people with serious diseases and disorders for which there are no good treatments that are linked to senescence, because we're worried about what I was talking about before, and that's risk-benefit ratio. So as you mentioned at the outset, the trials are underway for advanced Alzheimer's disease, stage 2 and 3, or very advanced, what we call mild cognitive impairment, verging on Alzheimer's disease. Or they're for trials with people with advanced age-related osteoporosis. Or there are trials for people with these childhood cancer survivors, for example, people who've had chemotherapy and radiation before the age of 10 for, say, leukemias. Many of these people do well throughout the rest of their lives, but some of them, because radiation and chemotherapy can induce senescent cells, some of them develop an accelerated aging-like state when they're 30 or 40. So St. Jude, who we're working with, they follow everybody they've treated for the remainder of their lives. And they did the studies. We helped them. They found that this accelerated aging-like state in 30 to 40-year-olds who've had cancer treatment, and I'd emphasize it's not everybody that this happens to. It's a small minority. But they're dying at 30 and 40 of Alzheimer's disease, second unrelated cancers, diabetes, osteoporosis, and they're frail, and they look like they're 70 when they're 30 or 40. So the National Cancer Institute has funded a trial, for example, in those people to test senolytics versus placebo to see if we can help those people. There, similarly, a trial has just been funded in Los Angeles area to look at accelerated aging-like states that can develop in adult cancer survivors. And there are trials occurring in the Netherlands looking at a similar sort of thing. So the initial trials with senolytics are for very serious conditions. There have been some trials just completed for something we call macular degeneration. It's a form of blindness that's related to senescence. And there was actually some return of vision in that trial. There are trials underway for cancers because you have to be able to form senescent cells to prevent cancers from developing. But once cancers have developed, if after radiation and chemotherapy, cells can either be killed or they can enter a senescent state. If they enter a senescent state and they're not killed by the radiation and chemotherapy, they continue to undergo mutations and they can escape senescence and come back as even worse cancers that are chemotherapy and radiation treatment resistant. So we've got an emergency clinical trial about to begin for a terrible tumor called glioblastoma. It's a brain tumor, stage 4 and stage 5. And that would be sequencing usual treatment for it, which is surgery, which sort of helps a little bit, but it's usually spread throughout the brain. Radiation and temozolomide, which is a kind of chemotherapy which is given for it. We're beginning to look at, can we prolong remission by giving senolytics after those agents to try to get rid of cancer-harboring senescent cells? And I predict there are going to be other kinds of cancer trials, most notably triple-negative breast cancer and others, that'll come along. So in other words, we're really starting in a lot of ways with senolytics with treatment trials.
Yeah,
and then we'll work backwards to secondary prevention and primary prevention.
Before we're deep into senolytics, can you just explain what are they for our audience? What are senolytics? And I know that you actually the first person to discuss it in your 2015 Aging Cells paper. So maybe discuss that, how you got into this idea and what are senolytics?
Well, we began working on it in Tamara and I were, Dr. Ciccone and I were still in Boston, in 2004 because Ned Sharpless, who later became head of the FDA for a while and then head of the National Cancer Institute, and he just retired from that position. He published a very important paper in 2004, showing that there's, an association between decreases in senescent cell numbers, these cells that don't divide, in animals that have mild caloric restriction, which prolongs health span, or animals with certain changes in their growth hormone, insulin-like growth factor 1 system that can prolong health span. So he noticed that those animals that live longer had a lower senescent cell burden. So he found an association. And based on that, Tamara and I asked, is there cause and effect? If we get rid of senescent cells, could we actually have an impact on health span and age-related diseases? So we started working using antibodies. These are molecules that would bind to a senescent cell and putting a toxic cargo on to see if we could kill them. Didn't get very far with that. We tried high-throughput screens, had a few hits, but didn't get very far with it. And then after we moved to Mayo and worked with Izu, who's in our lab still, it hit us in 2013, that some senescent cells, despite the fact they're killing cells around them, don't themselves die.
Yeah, the question was, what are, if you can just define what are senolytics, what are they doing, and how do they attack the senescent cells?
Yeah, cells we were trying to kill are the ones that produce factors that damage other cells around them. So some senescent cells don't produce factors that kill cells around them. Anywhere from 30 to 50% don't. So they produce growth factors and other things like that. But then there's another around 50% of senescent cells that produce factors that kill cells around them, yet they themselves don't divide. So we asked why, despite the fact these cells are releasing factors that kill things around them, why don't the senescent cells die? So we look for things that we call senescent cell anti-apoptotic pathways, or SCAPs. There, we asked, are there pathways that senescent cells use to defend themselves from the things that senescent cells are using to kill cells around them? And we discovered that there are at least 5 pathways. Now we know that there are 10. And that if we transiently disable those pathways through which senescent cells prevent themselves from self-destruction, that we could allow senescent cells to kill themselves instead of the cells around them. So this is basically how senolytics work. They don't kill every senescent cell. They only kill the senescent cells that are doing damage. They only kill the ones that are producing factors that are damaging cells around them by taking away the senescent cell's ability to resist those factors. So it's very different from the kinds of animal models where you base removing senescent cells on certain factors that those animal models express within senescent cells. So in other words, we're getting rid of the bad guy senescent cells and leaving behind the good guy ones. Now, in the cases of cancer, we've got to get rid of all of them. So the other thing we've had to do is find agents where we can take non-damaging senescent cells and turn them into damaging senescent cells so that we can use senolytics to kill them. So those are called senosensitizers, and that's a new class of drugs we're developing.
Wow. Are there a place or a category of certain types of diseases or tissues that produce more of these types of senolytic or senescent cells, the ones that are resistant to kind of killing themselves? Or, you know, that 30 to 50%, they can be kind of wherever, all over the place.
It's really any tissue with the right stimuli. So, and it can be non-dividing cells can become senescent too and produce damaging factors. It typically takes cells 1 to 6 weeks to become senescent, although there are some circumstances where they can become senescent very quickly. Like iron, for example, can make a cell become senescent within a day or two. But things like radiation or chemotherapy or other things that can cause a cell to become senescent, you know, damage related to cancers and so forth, or infections and so forth. Normally, it takes 1 to 6 weeks for a cell to become fully senescent and to produce bad things. So, and these cells don't divide. And that means if we're getting rid of them, we can get rid of them with intermittent treatments. It's unlike other kinds of conditions where cells are constantly producing things. If we can remove these cells every once in a while, instead of continuously, we get the same benefit, if not more, by doing that than giving drugs continuously. So one of the things we did was to develop drugs that would take away protection of senescent cells that senescent cells use to protect themselves from the things that they're killing cells around them. So the way senolytics work is by transiently disabling the defenses that senescent cells use to stop them from killing themselves instead of cells around them. And a very brief exposure to a senescent cell is sufficient to allow that senescent cell to begin an irreversible process of cell death, which takes 18 hours. So it only takes a few minutes of exposure of a senescent cell to a senolytic to activate that program and get rid of senescent cells. So these, given that it takes 1 to 6 weeks for new senescent cells to form, it means senolytics can be given in most circumstances once a week, once every 2 weeks, once a month. In some cases, say after radiation, if there's radiation like to a hind limb, for example, in mice, that causes senescence and they have trouble walking. We only have to give it once in the mouse's lifetime because there's no future radiation. We just have to give it once and that mouse is able to walk again for the remainder of its life, the same way as a mouse that has not had radiation. So the frequency of administering these drugs will depend very much on the disease state and how senescence is being induced to occur.
As a Longevity by Design podcast listener, you understand the value of improving your health for today and for all the years ahead. And if you want to live your healthiest, longest life possible, you need to understand what's going on inside. At Inside Tracker, we take a personalized approach to health span optimization that eliminates guesswork from your wellness plan. Inside Tracker analyzes blood biomarker and DNA data, along with physiomarker data from fitness trackers like Oura Ring, to deliver personalized food, supplement, lifestyle, and exercise recommendations that allow you to take control and improve your health span. And for a limited time, Longevity by Design listeners can get 20% off at the Inside Tracker store. So if you're ready to receive a personal health analysis and data-driven wellness plan to optimize your body for the long haul, then it's time to start inside. Visit insidetracker.com/podcast to get started today. That's insidetracker.com/podcast to get started today.
And can you walk us through an example of a specific senolytic, like, for example, cysteine, and how it's what is the mechanism that it's worked to eliminate senescent cells?
Well, what we found, as I mentioned before, we found by looking at senescent cells using early bioinformatics approaches, using what we call transcriptomic approaches, and then all kinds of computer programming, and then something called RNA interference, so we could interfere with particular genes. We found there's a network of pathways, the SCAP network, that defends senescent cells from killing themselves. And different kinds of senescent cells depend on different elements of this pathway. So some senescent cells depend on things that an agent called fezetin, which is a natural product. It's in strawberries, it's in cucumbers and certain other things. It transiently disables some of these pathways and allows those senescent cells that are tissue damaging to kill themselves instead of the cells around them. Fezetin has a very short elimination half-life. It is what we call the first pass elimination half-life of 5 minutes and an overall elimination half-life of 3 hours. So if it's taken, it's gone very, very quickly. And we find that we can give it once a month or once every 2 weeks in animal models and now in clinical trials. There's one that's about to be published looking at it in osteoarthritis, that we can successfully clear senescent cells. There are other agents related to the flavonoids that appear to do this. Another agent is quercetin. It's closely related to fezetin, and it's in clinical trials, but it's in trials with in combination with a drug that's called dasatinib. And dasatinib will kill different kinds of senescent cells than the flavonoids will. So in some cases, we combine senolytics, depending on the disease state, to try to kill senescent cells. And these studies have been done in animal models, that is, in mice, in rats, in monkeys, and other species. And there are clinical trials underway in people. The first few of them have been published. There was a trial in a condition called idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, which is a senescence-driven disorder that was published in 2019. That was in people with very serious disease. It was not placebo-controlled. It was just mainly to look for safety. But we did find people perform better. They had better walking speed, walking distance, chair rise, and something called short physical performance battery, but it didn't have a proper control group. So what we call a 2A trial is underway at the moment. And then there was another trial that was published in 2019 in people with obesity and diabetes who have, and early kidney failure, who have a lot of senescent cells. And in that trial, we found when we measured senescent cells looking at blood, and looking at tissue biopsies, that these agents, a brief course of these agents, successfully reduced burden of senescent cells. There are also trials that have been done looking at certain urine biomarkers of senescent cells in people, and we found that senolytics reduce those, or increase actually one of them that is goes down with age. It's called alpha-klotho. It's a good guy. If you overexpress it, you extend lifespan quite considerably in mice. We find senolytics make it go way up. Klotho also goes down in Alzheimer's disease and all kinds of other conditions. But in 20 out of 20 people, we found that urine alpha-klotho went way up. And then there are early results from a trial called STOMP-AD for Alzheimer's disease, where we found, this is only in 5 subjects, one paper's out, the second one's coming. We show that with other groups that we're able to reduce markers of senescence and also certain markers in spinal fluid related to Alzheimer's disease. So there are trials about to be published I can't talk about right at the moment because they're under peer review and I want to make sure they're reviewed before we say anything. But, and I'm touching wood, there appears to be some promise, early promise with these trials. But still, I've moved from giving these drugs a 0.0001% chance of working in people. I'm up to about a 30% chance I think they'll work. But there's a 70% chance they might not. You know, so we need to do the clinical trials and need to be very careful and really do these clinical trials in academic medical centers and make sure of what we're looking at and make sure we're measuring the right things and make sure they're replicated in more than one place. Because as a physician, I have to be conservative and I have to worry about the principle of first do no harm. So that's why we're taking this particular approach across the Geroscience Network. And we're looking at other things across that network too. So we're comparing senolytics to, say, metformin or to rapamycin or to sirtuin agonists or combining them with exercise and these kinds of things. So there, and then there are trials of the other things, you know, only about a fifth of the trials in that network that are underway are with different kinds of senolytics. There are other trials underway with metformin or rapalogs and so forth.
And something you pointed, you mentioned before of it's hard to test someone, or let's say run a trial for 60 years to see if there is that expansion in health span. You mentioned biomarkers that can be tested. Is that traditionally how you would determine if senescent cells are present or the specific type of senescent cell that might respond to one senolytic or another? How are those biomarkers kind of selected?
Well, that's a whole science in and of itself that we're working on as part of this network and many other people are working on. So what we try to do across these trials is measure the same things in blood, in urine, in sputum, in other samples from humans, including even things like microbiome and all kinds of things. And we're also, where feasible, doing biopsies of various tissues to look at senescent cell burden. And we're trying to develop imaging methods for senescent cell burden based on certain antibodies that senescent cells have and that others don't. So those are all very much a work in progress. In one of the initial trials we did develop with David Allison and his group at University of Indiana, a blood score for measuring senescent cells. And even though it was a very small number of subjects, those numbers went way down. And that was highly statistically significant. So we think we've got target engagement. And then there are physical function tests that need to be measured. There's a company, for example, that did trials for something called dry macular degeneration. And they were looking not only at the eye grounds, but at vision. And they found some hints that vision was improved by injecting a particular, senolytic agent into the eye.
And any evidence in model organism that senolytics can extend the lifespan? And if yes, can you elaborate on that?
Well, I'm not, as a physician, as I was saying before, my first interest is not necessarily lifespan. I haven't had patients come and ask me about that. Maybe 40-year-olds do, but certainly 70, 80, 90-year-olds, I've, in all my years of practice, never had it happen. They want to feel better. So we're more interested in looking at health span parameters.
Okay.
And the same in experimental animals. So there's mixed evidence about all of these kinds of agents. With metformin, there are mixed data. With senolytics, there are mixed data. With rapalogs, yes, things related to rapamycin, there are mixed data. So lifespan can be tricky to measure. And then if you're measuring it in animal populations, are you putting them under ideal conditions or real conditions? So a lot of the lifespan studies are done in animals that are under very, very protected conditions. For example, caloric restriction, a reducing amount of calories animals take in, extends lifespan in protected colonies. But I can tell you, if you put one of those mice that's caloric restricted into the wild, they would be the first ones that a cat would eat. You know, and So the same thing with drugs related to rapamycin. If they're in a protected colony where they're protected from viruses or bacteria, rapamycin will inhibit both mTORC1 and 2. It's not selective for mTORC1. So by hitting mTORC2, even lower doses of rapamycin can interfere with immune function a bit. And would that really, in animals living in the wild, extend lifespan or not, or would they get earlier infections? We don't know. So I think we need to rethink the way that we do some animal studies. There have already been steps taken to make sure that animals are outbred. In other words, that they're not a purely inbred species. But we need to look at everything else. Should, with mice, for example, we be walking a cat through the room periodically? Should we expose them to different temperatures? Should they have rain sprayed on them? Mm-hmm. Should there be thunderstorms? Should there be all the things that humans are exposed to when we're giving these agents? And we're talking about lifespan. So lifespan, I think, is an incredibly, it sounds like an easy thing to measure. It probably is in single-celled organisms. But once you get to multicellular organisms and you're asking, can we translate this through to people or to domestic animals? It becomes an entirely different issue.
Yeah.
And so what we need to do, in my view, is begin with looking at what we call health span. That is, can we delay, prevent, or alleviate multiple conditions, sometimes at once, and improve the quality of life? Can we improve cognitive function scores, physical function scores, those kinds of things with these kinds of agents in people with impairments in those things?
And have anyone done such an experiment on health span in model organism or not yet?
Yes, and it looks like many of these agents, if given the right way, can extend health span, provided they're given it the right way, in the right order, for the right conditions. So that is looking promising, more promising than lifespan and more consistent. But what's even more promising, again, is going after certain conditions for which we've got no treatments that are clearly related to cellular senescence and where we've got a pressing clinical need. So in those cases, in model organisms, there's pretty good evidence. Now, some diseases are very hard to replicate in model organisms. For example, there are all kinds of ways you can create an Alzheimer's-like state in mice, but mice don't naturally get Alzheimer's disease. So what you find in mice with drugs may not translate through to humans very well, in the case of Alzheimer's disease. With other disorders, like certain cancers or diabetes and obesity, findings in lower experimental animals are much more translatable.
Even there, it's not a one-to-one. There are a lot of...
Right.
Yeah.
And for example, mice have a huge pancreas.
Yeah.
They may get insulin resistance, but they don't get frank diabetes. Rats do. Mm. Dogs do. Horses do. Mice tend not to because they've got a gigantic pancreas. So they may have resistance to insulin.
Yeah.
But they have a big pancreas that produces a lot of insulin. So some of the models that you, if you're looking at insulin-dependent diabetes, you've got to reduce the size of the pancreas in a mouse, or you have to do it in rats, because rats, 20% of them spontaneously with aging will get frank diabetes, yeah, or dogs.
Yes. Yeah, so I'm trying to, again, go a 30,000 foot view. So it sounds like senolytics are like a magic drug in a way. They also prevent cancer, but also might allow us to live longer. That's a fair assessment as what we know today.
Well, I think anything that sounds too good to be true is, and we have to be really careful. We have to do, and things that look perfect, as I mentioned before, in animal models very often do not translate through to humans. It's only around 30% or even less of what we call phase 2A clinical trials that actually work, despite all the animal evidence that the Food and Drug Administration in the United States or the European Medicines Agency in Europe require before you can even start doing a trial. So things that look like they could be the best thing in the world very often fail in humans because, we humans are complicated. We're not living in a controlled environment. And that's why we need a personalized approach as well.
Yeah.
So, I think we have to be cautious in overinterpreting beneficial findings that we see in lower experimental animals when we come to people, and we have to do the clinical trials. We have to do them and check them, and we have to do them quickly. Yeah. And I think we have to expect a lot of the clinical trials will fail, but I don't think we should lose hope if some of them do, because by nature, many of them will fail. So that's why I think it's important to do some of these trials in parallel rather than in series, so that we're looking at multiple conditions across the world, with similar sorts of interventions and looking at biomarkers in a similar way, but looking at different kinds of outcomes and different kinds of populations and different kinds of disease states. And we need to move quickly on it because if this geroscience hypothesis and gerotherapeutics are effective and safe in humans, they could arguably, and I give it a 30% chance, they could arguably transform healthcare as we know it, maybe even more profoundly than antibiotics.
Well, that's a big statement, and I hope that you're right.
Well, I'm saying there's only a 30% chance moment.
Even 30%.
I'm up from a 0.001% chance. Yeah. You know, there's a good 70%+ chance I'm entirely wrong. Yeah. So we need to test it before people start taking these things over the counter. You know, we really need to know they're safe, effective, and we need to move fast.
Yeah. And I've seen a lot of flourish of biotech companies related to senolytics. I can say I know 10 or more companies like that. That's amazing that the field that you started, 8 years ago, something like that, already has so many companies and so much money is tunneling to those companies. That suggests that there are a lot of people or a lot of investors that agree with you with your statement that senolytics might be a part of the solution for both cancer and longevity.
Yeah, well, we'll see. I'm, as a clinician who's actually seeing patients in trials at the moment, I'm not allowed to participate or have conflicts of interest in companies. There are certain things I'm allowed to do, like I'm allowed to earn a certain amount per day for giving a talk or something like that. But there are strict limits in the US. But I think the commercialization side is going to be extremely important. I think they're going to have to be the right people doing it. And I think that has to move fast. I think another roadblock is to train people how to do some of these trials and not only do the trials in humans, but how to do what we call late phase preclinical trials in experimental animals that are acceptable to regulatory authorities. Because you need preliminary data before you're allowed to go to a human trial. And it's very, very complex. People don't realize how complex it is necessarily with a completely new agent or repurposing an agent for a medical indication. It's a heck of a lot of work to get a human trial going. Now, unfortunately, many drug companies are not too interested necessarily in taking existing compounds or natural products through to trials because it's hard to get what we call a composition of matter patent. There are some companies that have figured out how to do this. And I think we need to figure out ways where companies can be incentivized to study things like natural products or exercise interventions or other things, allow them to get some kind of reward for it so that these trials get done. Many of the companies are developing what we call new chemical entities where they can get patents and then do the trials. That adds time. And it may be necessary, but I think one of the things that governments have to do is go through and think, how do we get these things to people? And should there be non-state actors that get into this? I mean, non-drug company actors like state actors into it. Should various governments around the world be investing in this in places where drug companies normally wouldn't? And then we need to train the right workforce. There are very few clinical geriatricians who are also trained in basic science and can do early phase preclinical work, you know, from drug discovery work right through to translation. There are very few in the world. And so we need to create a new discipline of geroscience to train people how to do this, not just for senolytics, but for everything that we're talking about, for exercise interventions, for rapalogs, for metformin, for everything. And incidentally, metformin and rapalogs, I mentioned these things all interact. They work directly on senescent cells. So metformin, one of the main things it does is it decreases secretions by senescent cells of bad things, including not just proteins, but also some of the reactive metabolites and things related to RNA and DNA. Rapamycin, it inhibits some of the bad proteins that senescent cells produce. And both also decrease spread of senescence by affecting the SASP. So all of these things are tightly interlinked. And some of metformin's action may be through effects on senescent cells, and the same with rapamycin. Conversely, targeting senescent cells results in increases in something called NAD in tissues, because senescent cells produce factors that makes this important metabolite go down in tissues. So all of these things are interrelated. And I mentioned before this, you get rid of senescent cells, you have increases in what we call geroprotective factors like alpha-klotho. So these things are tightly interlinked, and we need to study how they're interlinked. So across these trials, we're measuring, say, with senolytics, we're not just measuring senescent cell burden. We're trying to measure all of these fundamental aging processes. What happens to the immune system? What happens to protein turnover, the kinds of things that rapamycin affects? What happens to the sirtuins, you know, things that resveratrol affects? Muscle function, everything else. So I think across these trials, we need to get to agreed upon measures or at least store samples from clinical trials with subjects' consent for the broader research community so we can do reverse translation and check out all the pillars of aging, even if a company or an academic group is doing a clinical trial. We need to think about that. And the National Institutes of Health has moved quite quickly to establish a biorepository where samples from across these trials, hopefully in the near future, can be stored for everybody to access in a protected facility in Frederick, Maryland that the NIH runs.
Fun fact, I'm from Frederick, Maryland. Who knew? Well, thank you for that detailed kind of explanation that gave like a really good holistic overview of where we need to go in aging research and science to meet a lot of these goals. And I am going to take your suggestion of a department cat back to my chair because I think our grad students would love to take care of a cat to roam through the labs. As we noted in the introduction, you're the principal investigator for the NIH Translational Geroscience Network. Can you explain to us what that is, what the goals of that are?
Yeah, it's a grant. It's a small grant, relatively small in NIH terms. I think the NIH wants to figure out ways to expand it and make it more permanent. You'd have to ask them, but that's my impression. And what that grant involves is over a dozen medical centers across the U.S. Directly, and then investigators at many more. And the idea is to help them do clinical trials and even to write grants to get the clinical trials done. So the actual clinical trials are being funded by various branches of the National Institutes of Health, not just the Aging Institute, but National Cancer Institute, Heart, Lung, and Blood, and others. Some are being funded by the U.S. Navy. Some of them are being funded by private foundations like the Alzheimer's Foundation or Alzheimer's Drug Discovery Foundation. Some are being funded by philanthropists, and some are being funded by companies. But what the Translational Geroscience Network is there to do is to help people design and write their trials, to write their grants, to deal with regulatory authorities in the way that regulatory authorities want it to be done. So we help them with the Food and Drug Administration, and now increasingly with the European Drug Agency. And then we're facilitating conducting analyses across these trials of things in blood, in urine, and other samples, so that we're measuring those things currently and mainly in one place. But we want to diversify this across the country in case a tornado takes down the place where they're currently being done, because we want to be able to do replicates. We want to be able to do the same kinds of measures under very carefully controlled conditions across the trials. So, for example, across these trials, we're currently measuring about 67 things in blood. And that's just, you know, that's things other than some of the nucleotides like mitochondrial DNA. We're measuring 35 parameters in urine. If we can get biopsies, we're doing things in a standardized way. We're trying to introduce across all these trials a minimum subset of quick tests that can be done, like of brain function and so forth, even if the trial is for a skin disease. We want to see if this geroscience hypothesis is true, whether we can affect every organ system. And then we've got a run out of Wake Forest University and with collaborators at University of Indiana and elsewhere, a data management center where samples are being, data and statistics are being analyzed in a standardized way, because we have to use very different statistical and bioinformatics approaches for these kinds of trials than the usual trials. And then George Cushall of the University of Connecticut is working on the biorepository part of it, where we're trying to, from every trial, get mirror image samples that we can put we can make sure are stored under similar conditions in the same kinds of tubes so that basic researchers can get access to those samples and do what we call reverse translation and look in humans to see if the things they're finding in animals work in response to interventions retrospectively. And then we're also keeping those samples so that we can do prospective studies, you know, of new biomarkers or things that change and may be causative of fundamental aging processes as they're developed. Every week, there's a new one that comes along. So we want to be able to go back in these trials and measure those things. So that's what the network does. So it doesn't actually fund the trials. It provides advice about running them. It helps coordinate them and helps get samples, make sure they're, it does analyze the samples, although the individual trials principal investigators pay for use of that facility because otherwise it would be prohibitively expensive. And we're just trying to do things in a coordinated, well thought out way, as well as running educational programs and so forth, as well as developing what we call standard operating procedures, like how do you draw the blood? How do you store it? How do you process it? What kinds of tubes do you put it in? How do you ship it? These things sound trivial, but they are not. You know, you can have tremendous errors if you're not really careful about all of this.
And have you done any trial via this vehicle or not yet?
There are 85 trials currently underway. Some of them are about to be published. They're under peer review at the moment, so I'll just say to me, my uneducated look at them, one particular one or two of them look very, very promising.
Okay.
But it's still, you know, still early days. And many of these trials are what we call phase one trials, or they're adaptive trials, you know, so they're early. There are some trials that are what we call phase 2A that are placebo controlled. Some of them are partway through. But we have to take these things, you know, we're trying to do what we can as quickly as possible and in parallel.
Yeah. And some of them, I assume, are on the senolytics. That's correct?
30 of them or so are with different kinds of senolytics, yes.
Interesting.
Is there a condition that you can see, like the first real clinical usage in the future that you think these senolytics would be used in? You know, what specific condition maybe would they perhaps be able to benefit first?
I think the word perhaps is a key word, and I wouldn't want to go and give too much false hope at this point, but I'm hoping there are a number of neurodegenerative conditions. I think some of the interesting trials are looking at, can we rehabilitate organs from older donors so they can be used on younger recipients? So very, very early trials, we're looking at that. Currently in the U.S., we're throwing away 24,000 kidneys a year, mainly because they're from older donors. Pancreases, we're not transplanting pancreases from people over age 45, just because the surgeons have found it doesn't work very well, even if it looks good. And then we found in experimental animals with the group in Stefan Tullius at Harvard, that if we transplant hearts from old animals to young animals, there's all kinds of dysfunction that's caused in the young animal because of spread of senescence from that old heart. Mm. But if we treat with senolytics, either the donor animal, the heart itself while it's waiting to be transplanted, or the recipient, we can reduce deaths. So I'd see the transplant field as being an area that's worth emphasis. I don't know that these drugs will work there yet, but it's certainly a place where, since organs are being discarded anyway, we're actually studying human organs on these systems that they use if, you know, there's a car crash, to transfer the organ from the car crash to, you know, the operating room on a helicopter or whatever. We're adding drugs sort of to organs that they would have normally thrown away because they're from older donors who've signed organ donation cards. But it would be nice one day if people who died, if their organs could be shared amongst several recipients. It would make, you know, death is a horrible thing, but it might make even the people donating their organs before they die feel better, that they might be adding something for all kinds of people. I think other areas are going to be important to look at and are being looked at, like some of these lung diseases, heart diseases, liver diseases, kidney diseases, certain very, very serious skin conditions, blindness, and a whole range of other conditions for which there are no really good treatments. I just hope that they work. I don't know that they will. You know, we'll just have to wait and see. And especially for some of the horrible cancers, you know, where if you see one cell on a slide, you have to tell the person with that cancer, start saying goodbye to your family. You know, so that's one area where we're really trying to move as fast as we can. I don't know what the results will be. The National Cancer Institute in 2021 published a couple of articles saying that it's very important to think about sequencing chemotherapy and radiation with gerotherapeutics. They specifically talked about senolytics and doing clinical trials to see if we can improve outcomes. You know, the trials are not published yet. We don't know. You know, but I think that's a very important area. Cause, you know, when I was a medical student, I hated it as any normal person would when 30-year-olds were dying in my arms.
Sure.
Yeah. And you mentioned earlier that even rifamycin and maybe metformin can be seen as maybe senolytic agent in different ways. What about diet and exercise? Do you think that diet and exercise, or is there any evidence that when you exercise and when you eat well, you get rid for more senescent cells than someone that is not?
Actually, I just published a paper with Jamie Justice, who you talked about earlier, who just published the first of those trials. And it looked like, indeed, if you look at certain lifestyle interventions, there's some indication that you can decrease senescent cell burden.
Well, that's
and that really, paper just came out.
That's really exciting. I will definitely look at that. So exciting to see that someone that eat well and exercise can also eliminate senescent cells from his body.
An extra benefit.
Yeah.
And, you know, is there something that really excites you the most about the potential for extending health span with these specific therapies or drugs or other interventions in the coming years?
Well, I think health span is extremely important. I think, again, as a physician who, you know, is seeing patients, some of these horrible diseases that you can do nothing about, to me, it's a little bit against what the rest of the field says, but to me personally, I'd love it if some of these interventions could be used, in those situations to help people's quality of life and to maybe even, do more than that.
And we end with one question that we ask all of our guests, if there is a top tip or something that you do in your own life that related to health that you would mind sharing with our listeners.
Well, sorry, one thing. I hesitated when I was talking to you a bit earlier, and that's because I had a page and was dealing with something that, you know, so I just wanted to leave my apologies about that when we were talking about how senolytics work. So for me, the patient comes first. Sorry about that.
Yeah, of course.
I think, this is an area that's worth, arguably considerable investment in. We need to move quickly and we need to know, do these things work or not sooner rather than later. So I think, this area, if we're talking about priorities of societies and governments and things like that, if this stuff happened to work, slim chance, it might mean that human life would be more valuable. It, might arguably mean that it could lead to a little less conflict in the world. You know, so there's some big picture things just might, if this stuff comes about and it's a wild dream that it might, but it would alter the way that we look at things. A long time ago in the 1800s, people didn't worry that much about children because most of them died before they reached adulthood. So they expected most of their children to die, and they had lots of children because they expected that. Now children are highly valued because we can save them. Maybe with elderly individuals, they can continue to work. They continue to raise grandchildren. And arguably, some of the biggest benefits of geotherapeutic interventions, if they work, would be in places like sub-Saharan Africa. So there are health economists around who've got really good data indicating that. So the number of children has gone way down in Africa. The number of elderly has gone up. And in sub-Saharan Africa, people depend on physical labor. You know, so the benefits to some of those societies when I'm not an economist, but these really genius economy types look at it, like from Stanford and London School of Economics and things. The benefits could arguably be even bigger in the developing world than in the developed world. So I think this is an area that we need to focus on. We need to have some go, no go milestones where we decide, do we continue to invest? But there needs to be a lot more effort put into this than the traditional one drug, one target, one disease approach. And maybe arguably we need to put more into this than we do into fighting wars or other things that we're doing.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. That was a great episode. And we love to learn a lot about senescent and senolytics. And I think that the future looks bright, at least as of today. And I hope that what we see today will become reality in, I don't know, 5 years or 10 years. And all of us will enjoy the fruits of your discoveries. So thank you so
much. Well, it's not me. This is a whole lot of people. I'm just one person out of many.
Absolutely.
And again, my apologies for hesitating earlier, but I had a patient situation. Sorry about that.
No, not a problem at all. And again, we appreciate your time and we appreciate all the knowledge that you shared with our listener. That was a great episode. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Longevity by Design. Please subscribe to this podcast on Apple, Spotify, or YouTube. Longevity by Design is powered by Inside Tracker, a personalized health optimization platform that helps people improve their lives by improving their bodies from the inside out using personalized, science-backed recommendations for nutrition, supplements, and lifestyle changes. To learn more, visit insidetracker.com/podcast.